right, today is the first day of class. This is Tuesday, August the 15th, and I am recording. So I just want to let you know that what is going on now is going on the live recording. We're going to start with the endocrine system. This is page 3 of your course pack. If you want to follow along in the textbook, it's page 586 in that textbook. So I kind of want to get your brain thinking in gears of where you left off. I know some of you took Bio-210 this summer semester, and the nervous system is probably pretty recent in your memory. If you took Bio-210 in the spring semester, I know it's been since May that you probably talked about all this endocrine stuff or nervous system stuff. So just to kind of get your brain working in gear for our new system here, let's go back and talk about the nervous system for just a minute. So how does the nervous system work in terms of one neuron telling another neuron what to do?
It uses synapse, it uses neurotransmitters.
Good.
And it relies on depolarization in order to activate that signal to other axons.
Good. Okay, so we're talking like a synapse.
Sorry.
That's right, good. So we're talking like a synapse between two neighboring cells. We're looking at chemical neurotransmitters communicating between those cells. And in terms of speed, you know, we're looking at a pretty quick communication between two neighboring cells that are only separated by a very small gap of space called a synaptic cleft. So we can get a very quick response for skeletal muscles or for other kinds of muscles in our bodies, but that is not the case when we're looking at the endocrine system. So just to lay it out here, the nervous system is a faster system. It does work with synapses and with chemicals called neurotransmitters, where the endocrine system tends to be a slower system. In this case, we still use chemical messengers, but they don't work the same way neurotransmitters do. These chemical messengers are called hormones. So how do hormones travel? Bloodstream. Yeah, they travel in the bloodstream, okay? So it's the equivalent of taking a bullet train to get to your destination. That's how fast the nervous system works, as opposed to taking a slow boat with no oars to your destination. That's how the endocrine system works. It's a much slower system. So let me give you an example of how the endocrine system works, and it's in fact a slower system. When babies are born, they're on average about 20 inches long. It takes, say, 15, 18 years to get you to your final destined height. And, you know, we may grow 5 feet, 6 feet, or 7 feet tall. So it takes over the course of almost 2 decades to eventually get to your final destination, you know, some 5, 6, 7 feet tall. That's the endocrine system at work. It's not a fast-acting system. It takes months and years for the effects of the endocrine system to play out. So that's the catch here, is endocrine is a slower system. Those hormones are not necessarily fast-acting, but their effects may occur over days, weeks, months, or even years. Nervous system's effects are meant to be felt immediately. So just to remind you how the nervous system works, there are neurotransmitters that are communicating between neighboring cells. And of course, that's a quick job for that message to be relayed to the neighboring cell. But in the case of our endocrine system, these hormones that travel our bloodstream have to wait for circulation to transport them around the entire human body. All right, something else for us to take a look at. You probably heard of exocrine glands back in Bio-210. What does exo tell us? Outside, good. Endo is a prefix, means?
Inside,
right. So exocrine glands are those like sweat glands. What else?
Tears.
Mammary, yep. Oil glands, sweat glands, tears, even earwax fall into that category. What they all have in common in this exocrine category is the presence of a tube system. And we call this a duct system, not a quack-quack duct, but it's a tubing system that transports these excretions to the outside of the body. Take a look at the picture on the right. You're looking at a thyroid gland. Do you see the duct system there? No duct system. are hormones intended for the external part of your body? Are they intended to go into your skin surface? Nah. They're intended to go into your bloodstream, to some target organ inside your body. So you'll notice the picture on the right, there is no duct system here. The intended destination for those hormones is not to the external part of your body, but rather into your bloodstream, to some target organ or target tissue. All right, so we've got the thyroid gland as one of our examples. Can you think of some other examples in our endocrine category?
Pituitary,
good. What else?
Adrenal.
Thymus, good. Okay. What's that? Pineal, that's it. Yeah, it's a weird one. Pancreas, ovaries, testes, all these fall into this particular loose organ system category. So this is going to blow your mind, but, you know, the endocrine system is actually not a system in the true sense of the word. You know, how do most organ systems operate? Take the digestive. How does that system operate? Something comes in, it goes out the other end. And what do all those organs in the digestive system do? Break down food, and they have a common purpose, right? The endocrine system is not really working for a common purpose. You've got hormones that control reproduction and sex. You've got hormones that control the rate of growth or mitosis. You've got other hormones that control your blood pressure or blood volume. So when we call this a system, we do so very loosely. What they have in common as endocrine glands is the fact that they secrete hormones into your bloodstream. But I want to make the point here that these endocrine glands don't actually work for a common goal or a common purpose. Each one of them has vastly different purposes in our body. All right, near the bottom of your page, let's just review these common endocrine glands. Let's see, letter A looks like the pineal gland or pineal body. If you need the spelling for letter A, it's P-I-N-E-A-L. All right, how about letter B? Posterior. Yeah, posterior pituitary. Letter B is posterior pituitary. Letter C is partly labeled for us. It is anterior pituitary. Okay, look closely at letters D and E. They're sitting nearby one another. Letter D specifically is the thyroid gland. It sits around your trachea. And we can all feel our thyroids by feeling for the Adam's apple. It's a little protrusion there on your thyroid, or right above your thyroid gland. And right below that protrusion or Adam's apple is going to be your fleshy thyroid gland. I want to contrast that with your thymus gland. Notice it's found a little bit lower. It's actually in your chest cavity. It sits over your heart and right up underneath your sternum. So thymus gland is actually letter E on that picture. All right, what about letter F?
Adrenal,
good. The adrenals sit on top of the kidneys, good. Looks like letter G is pancreas. Letter G is pancreas. And letters H and I are the gonads. To be specific, letter H are ovaries. And I are testes. Okay. So tell me what you know so far about hormones. Messengers, good. Chemical messengers. What else do you know? Travel in the bloodstream. Good, good. In terms of speed, which system is faster, endocrine or nervous?
Nervous,
right. And of course, endocrine is having to wait on your blood to distribute those hormones around your body. So we've pretty much got the definition here. The top of the next page, hormones are considered chemical messengers. They do travel the bloodstream. And their job is to affect target areas. So let's talk about target areas for just a moment. In a female who produces estrogen, can you think of some places in her body that might be target areas of estrogen?
Uterus.
Breast tissue, good. Uterus, good. Okay. So perhaps other parts of her body may not have targets for estrogen. And what we're thinking about here are receptor sites for that estrogen hormone to link to. Let's think about another one. Let's talk about growth hormone, for instance. I know you've talked about that back in Bio210. Where are some parts of your bodies that are definitely target areas for growth hormone?
Your bones.
Your bones. Yeah, hair. Muscles, okay? So pretty much every cell in your body has a target site on it for growth hormone or a receptor site. Some have, of course, more predominant effects when growth hormone is bound to those receptor sites. So the point is that not every cell in your body has a receptor for every single hormone. We only have receptors on our target areas for those hormones. So that's kind of where we're heading with this. The next thing on your worksheet talks about the two chemical categories of hormones. We classify hormones based on what they're made from. One grouping is called the amino acid-based category, and that's how protein hormones operate. The other category of hormones are considered steroids. Thinking back, we know that steroids are categorized as lipids. Did everybody get a chance to do the sign-in sheet today? Y'all all got a chance to sign in? So let me take you back to Bio210, the very first part of that course. You guys probably talked about plasma membrane structure. I want to revisit that topic for just a moment. Okay, so the plasma membrane is made up of two layers of phospholipids. There are proteins embedded in that phospholipid bilayer. And there's all sorts of structures out here on this external surface that we call the glycocalyx. Some of those external structures serve as receptor sites for hormones or even for neurotransmitters. So when you look at the list of items that hormones may behave as, you've got them behaving as proteins or you've got them behaving as lipids. All right, so which of these two classes includes really big molecules?
Proteins,
yeah. So when you look at the plasma membrane and you have a really big protein coming to encounter that plasma membrane, you don't want to let a protein pass through the phospholipid bilayer. What could happen to your cell if you let a really big structure travel through your phospholipids? Yeah, rupture up your cell, right? Burst it. So instead of letting protein-based hormones burst their way through your cell membrane, we say, okay, whoa, you stop on the outside. One of these structures out here will serve as a receptor site, and it will intercept that protein. So it says, hey, protein, I know what you're doing. I got your message. So you can't come in. You're too big, but I'll take your message inside for you. So that prevents the cell from experiencing rupture due to having a really big protein-based hormone come in. So lipids are a different story, though. Let's go back and talk about the phospholipid bilayer for just a moment. These phospholipids are a little different. The head surface out here and the tail surface inside are actually made up of different types of lipid parts. Which part of your phospholipid bilayer hates water?
The tails,
yeah. And they are hydrophobic, but those tails also love fat. So anything fat-based can travel through those tails, but if it's water-based, it cannot travel through those phospholipid tails. So when you look at our list here and you say, okay, I've got lipids, which are steroid-based hormones, they can squeeze through the phospholipid bilayer and go right into the cell. So there's not a size issue here for the lipids. There's a chemical issue, and the chemical issue means that those phospholipid tails love the fats. So fat-based hormones get to travel right on through that phospholipid bilayer. Okay? So the proteins and lipid hormones behave in two totally different mechanisms here. So the names of these mechanisms are direct gene activation for your lipid-based hormones, and secondary messenger is the activation mechanism for our protein-based hormones. Okay, so I'd like to walk you through each of these mechanisms separately. We're going to start off with the secondary messenger system. That's the system that proteins use to activate their target cells. Most hormones in your body are, in fact, protein-based hormones. That means that most hormones in your body utilize a secondary messenger system to talk to their target cells. Okay, so here comes a protein-based hormone. Our example here is epinephrine, and because it's a protein-based hormone, keep in mind it's a big hormone. It's too big to fit and squeeze through our phospholipid bilayer. So the cell says, hey, whoa, stop there. You're too big. You can't come in. And instead, what epinephrine does, because it's a protein-based hormone, it's going to come and bind to a receptor outside of your cell. In fact, here it is. This receptor sits on your plasma membrane, and notice the pretty nice fit that it has with your protein-based hormone. So it's kind of like a lock and a key fit. If there is a receptor on your cell membrane for that protein-based hormone, then that protein-based hormone can fit into that receptor site. Once the hormone binds to the receptor on the plasma membrane, that turns on a domino effect of changes inside the cell. So it's like putting a key into the lock, turning it, and then boom, you've got all of these different chemical reactions that occur. Notice inside, we're going to have ATP degrade down to something called CAMP, and that's CAMP for short. So thinking back, what is ATP? Energy, right? Okay, so if ATP is energy, AMP is really low energy. So ATP is what we really want for an energy molecule, It's adenosine triphosphate with three phosphate groups. AMP is adenosine monophosphate. That M stands for one phosphate group. So I just wanted you to know that CAMP or CAMP is actually a relative of ATP. The important thing to know about CAMP, though, is this. It serves as a second messenger, okay? So why can't the hormone just come in the cell and tell what it wants the cell to do?
It's too big.
Too big. Got to stay outside. So if you put the hormone into a receptor site, what does CAMP now do for you?
Sends the message inside.
Takes the message inside, right. So CAMP is turned on. CAMP is now the second messenger. Your first messenger was, in fact, your hormone docked out there on the plasma membrane. So simply having that hormone dock with your plasma membrane, that receptor out there, we're going to activate CAMP, and it's going to carry out the job that the hormone would have done had it been able to get inside. Okay? So CAMP goes and turns on this thing here called protein kinase. Do you recognize the ending of A-S-E?
It's an enzyme.
It's an enzyme. Good. What do enzymes do for a living?
They break down.
They break down. They may join together. They speed up chemical reactions, right? So their job is to be some type of catalyst to make reactions work more quickly. And you're right. They may make those reactions where they break down something or where we build up something. It just depends on what we're doing. So the case here is that the hormone docks with the receptor. It's too big to come inside the cell, so we send message by way of a second messenger. The second messenger is known as CAMP. Good. CAMP's inside the cell, and then CAMP turns on enzymes. Enzymes we know will help catalyze or speed up chemical reactions. So if this was growth hormone is in fact a protein-based hormone. It would dock with receptors on the plasma membrane of your cells. Okay? And of course, that's going to make CAMP active inside your cell, and CAMP turns on protein kinase. What do you think protein kinase tells your cells to do when growth hormone has docked?
Grow.
Yep, speed up the growth, right? So it tells those cells, hey, undergo mitosis more quickly. And so that's how a protein-based hormone like growth hormone can work. What if I don't want my cells to grow? What could I do to this whole process to stop my cells from growing?
Cut off the receptor.
Cut off the receptor, exactly. So if I put a plug in that receptor and I don't let the hormone dock with that receptor, what happens to all that business on the inside? Doesn't happen, right? So there's all kinds of medications and drugs out there that block hormones from doing their jobs. They basically plug up that receptor site and say, hey, hormone, keep on moving. There's nothing here for you to see. There's no receptor site for you to plug into. So that's how a lot of medications or drugs will block the effects of hormones. Okay. I'm going to give you an example of how this works, just kind of thinking outside the box here for just a moment. If your friends have adopted an elephant and the elephant now lives in your neighborhood, the elephant wants to come over and play with you. Elephants are too big to come through your front door, right? Okay, so how do they get your attention? Knock on the door. Okay, so when they knock on the door, they're basically serving the job of binding with what? The receptor. Yeah, binding with the receptor. Okay, so you know the elephant lives in the neighborhood, and you know the elephant wants to play. You know when the elephant knocks on the door, that means it's time to play. So mom comes and gets you and says, hey, elephant wants to play. What is mom serving as?
Camp.
Camp, yep. She is the second messenger. And then she says, hey, elephant's here to play. She turns on protein kinase, and then now you get ready to go and play with the elephant. So elephant can't come in your house. Elephant's too big to come through the front door, any door for that matter. So it always has to stay on the outside. So in the case of a secondary messenger system, where must the receptor sit?
On the outside.
On the outside, yeah. Can't be inside because, hey, your protein can't get in. It's got to have a receptor on the plasma membrane. Okay. Does this make sense so far? Okay. Let's go back. There's two kinds of hormones. Most hormones are proteins. There's a handful that are lipids, okay? And the ones that are lipids come from your adrenal glands on top of your kidneys or your sex hormones. Sex hormones come from ovaries or testes. So it's not a huge group here, it's just adrenal hormones and sex hormones. We know that sex hormones like estrogen, testosterone are lipid-based. And how do lipids get along with your plasma membrane? They love each other, right? So the tails of that phospholipid bilayer say, hey, you're made of fat just like me, so come right on through into the cell. So would it make sense to put your receptor for a lipid on the outside surface of your cell? No, because that lipid says, oh, I'm going to slip on in. I'm going to get into that cell. So the thing to do is to put your receptor for that hormone inside the cell. In fact, steroids are kind of bossy. They don't just come into your cell. They come into your kitchen. They come into your living room. They come into your bedroom. They say, here I am. I'm your lipid for the day. These lipids come into your nucleus. That is the control center of your cell. And in fact, that is where we house our receptor for those lipid-based hormones. Okay, so lipids do not have their receptor on the outside surface. Instead, they have what's called an intracellular receptor. And if you have a blank there on page 4, it is for the term intracellular. If you happen to have an older course pack, it's on the top near page 5. So lipid hormones mean business. They barge into your cell, they come into your nucleus, they bind with the receptor inside your nucleus, and together, the receptor and hormone travel to your DNA and bind a region of your DNA. There, they turn on transcription of your DNA, and that transcribed DNA becomes RNA. That RNA travels out into your cytoplasm, where it hooks up with a ribosome, and we translate that into a protein. So what are we describing here? Transcription and translation.
Protein synthesis.
Protein synthesis, good. So all of our lipid-based hormones turn on protein synthesis. All of them make proteins grow. So all of our lipid-based hormones turn on protein synthesis. All of them make proteins grow. But you knew that before you came in here, right? Okay? So we know that testosterone has what effect on the human body? Muscles, yeah. Testosterone makes muscles grow. What influence does testosterone have on hair growth? Makes hair grow. So we knew about this, we just didn't link it together. So now we understand that lipid hormones make proteins grow, whether it's hair, muscle, other enzymes, other kinds of proteins, whatever it is, we're going to see protein synthesis activate when lipids are in the neighborhood of a cell with a target. Okay, so something to think about, something to appreciate here. What if a lipid-based hormone goes into a cell and there is no receptor for it? What happens to that cell? Nothing. Okay, so in order for that hormone to have any influence over that cell, what must that cell have? A receptor, right. And so if you have a receptor, then you're called a target. Okay, so it's like having a doorbell on your house. If you've got a doorbell in your house, you're a target for somebody to come and ring your doorbell. Take the doorbell away and you're no longer a target, so to speak. So if you happen to have a receptor, whether it's on the plasma membrane or inside the cell, you are now a potential target for hormones coming to ring your bell. Okay, so this depends on whether they ring your plasma membrane receptor or the one inside, depends on what they're made of. All right, so how about questions so far on secondary messenger versus direct gene activation? So far, so good. Okay. Top of page 5 has three terms for us to talk about. These are hormone relationships. Some hormones give permission for other hormones to do their job. They are called permissive hormones. One great example of a permissive relationship is between thyroid hormone and other hormones like estrogen. If thyroid hormone is present at a cell and is bound to the receptor inside the cell, then we can have estrogen come along and do its job. So when we realized this is what was happening, doctors said, okay, instead of giving women fertility drugs, we might be able to just give them thyroid hormone. Thyroid hormone allows for the sex hormones to do their job, and if a woman is trying to get pregnant, this allows for those sex hormones to function at the cellular level. So kind of a cool thing there, that permissiveness allows one hormone to give permission for the other one to do its job. What if the permissive hormone is not present? Can the second hormone come along and function?
No.
Yep, so it takes one hormone giving permission for the other one to do its function. So I kind of think of it like this. If you're 8 years old and you want to go to the movies and you're waiting for mom or dad to take you to the movies, they give you permission and they give you the ride to see the movies. If mom or dad says, nope, you're not going to the movies and definitely not giving you a ride, you're stuck. You know, you can't do anything. You can't go and see the movies on your own. So that's kind of how permissiveness works with hormones. So how do synergistic hormones work?
They work together.
They work together. Good. How about antagonistic hormones?
They work against each other.
Work against each other. Good. So we'll come upon plenty of examples of synergists and antagonists as we work through this chapter. Something else we want to talk about is how hormones are released. You'll notice three terms listed here: humoral, neural, and hormonal. So back when people started discovering how our bodies work, you know, 1400s, 1500s, 1600s, 1700s, they started calling our bodily fluids the humors, which is kind of a weird thing because it's certainly not funny. There's nothing funny about blood or bile or saliva, but nonetheless, the word has stuck around. When you hear the word humoral, we want to think of blood concentration of a hormone. In fact, if you're thinking about glucose in the bloodstream, glucose has a certain concentration that has to be maintained during a narrow range. What is normal blood glucose supposed to be?
80.
That sounds good, 80 to 100. I've heard 70 to 110, 120. So wherever you're looking at, it's a really tight range, right? So when you're looking at glucose concentration in the bloodstream, you're looking at humoral control of that blood glucose. Do you happen to know the name of the hormones that control blood glucose levels?
Insulin
and glucagon. Good. So they, in fact, operate under humoral stimulation. If blood glucose levels are too high or if they're too low, that is going to be a humoral stimulation that tells the pancreas to release those hormones into the bloodstream. Let's see, neurostimulation is another way that hormones may get released by their glands. Sometimes nervous system wiring, especially sympathetic nervous system wiring, will tell an endocrine gland to release a hormone. So if I come in here and say, okay, on Thursday we're going to have a test and put your notes and your books away, what system of the autonomic branch have I activated?
Sympathetic,
right. That turns on the release of two neurotransmitters or hormones known as
epinephrine and norepinephrine.
Yeah, epinephrine and norepinephrine, right. So the case of sympathetic nervous system activating hormones is also something that can happen. And finally, hormonal stimulation is also a good way for many of our hormones to work. And in this case, one hormone from one gland tells another gland to make its hormones. So imagine if you live in a family with siblings. Mom tells your brother to tell you to clean up your room. That's hormonal stimulation. Okay, so the pituitary works like this. The pituitary releases hormones that tell other parts of your body to release hormones. So it's kind of a pass-the-buck type of system. This is also something we're going to detail as we work through this chapter. So if any one of these is not terribly clear right now, I do think after we work through this stuff, the next several class periods, it'll start to become a little more clear. Okay. Instead of getting you onto page 6, I know you guys are just getting used to your first day on for this class. Let me cut you loose. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to entertain those. We're going to start with hypothalamus and pituitary gland on Thursday. So that's what you're going to want to read ahead on for Thursday.